welcome to Speaking with Joy, a podcast about books, beauty, and music. So make yourself a cup of tea, sit down, and let's begin. There are only two kinds of people in the end, those who say to God, "Thy will be done," and those to whom God says, in the end, "Thy will be done." All that are in hell choose it. Without that self-choice, there could be no hell. No soul that seriously and constantly desires joy will ever miss it. Those who seek, find. To those who knock, it is opened. Well, hello everyone, and welcome back to Speaking with Joy, or Reading with Joy as it is this summer, because we are doing a book club on The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis. I'm so happy to have you all back, and to be looking this week at Chapter 9 of The Great Divorce. As I am sitting talking to you today, it is an unbelievably hot day in Colorado, and yet I am still drinking tea, because I can do no other. I'm excited to talk to you all about this week's chapter, because it really, to me, sums up the themes of the whole book. And really gets down to the questions that Lewis is asking about choice and desire and what that looks like brought to this kind of final completion in the way he's portraying heaven and hell. And this paragraph really seems to capture that, even consolidated more than even in the chapter. And what I find so interesting about this quote is that it has this sense of both being broad and being harsh. On the one hand, you have this line that says, "No soul that seriously and constantly desires joy will ever miss it." And that seems hopeful. It seems like Lewis is portraying the idea that people won't sort of miss heaven on accident. They won't miss heaven out of ignorance. But on the other hand, there's kind of a harshness to this saying. It's saying that there really is a choice between heaven and hell. So this week, we'll be working through what Lewis means by this and looking at it through the eyes of George MacDonald. Now, this is a rather long chapter, and I think that's because it is such a central chapter for this book. And essentially, to kind of give a little bit of a recap, as I like to do, for what happened in this chapter, what happens is that it opens up and we see he's invited to sit next to his literary hero, George MacDonald, and I'll tell you a little bit more about George MacDonald in a bit. He was one of Lewis's greatest inspirations. Lewis says that George MacDonald baptized his imagination. So long before Lewis ever became a Christian or religious, he read a copy of Phantastes, which is a very strange book. It's funny, I've read a good bit of MacDonald, and Phantastes is this very kind of bizarre novel that's kind of dreamlike and episodic, but Lewis just loved it, and he says that it baptized his imagination, and that it almost kind of gave him a way to practice belief. So Lewis kind of credits with MacDonald for a good deal of that movement for him. And MacDonald is a significant figure because he was a Scottish, he wrote tons and tons, he's a Scottish author. He was also a pastor. He came from a very strict Calvinist background that was very harsh and very legalistic. And he kind of worked that out with fear and trembling after some doubt, and came down to what many would call a universalism, kind of a perspective that everyone in the end, all the little lambs of God will end up in heaven. Now, what's interesting is that Lewis kind of, I always think he augments MacDonald's universalism, because obviously this kind of sounds like he's not exactly portraying universalism. But something that I think is funny about George MacDonald is that, and a professor pointed this out to me, even as George MacDonald rejected the predestination, the kind of double predestination that he perceived in Calvinism, he kind of created his own predestination with universalism. So where Calvinists might say we're all damned unless God saves us, it seems like George MacDonald goes ahead and just predestines that everyone be saved. But Lewis kind of augments this and kind of creates a caveat, and that caveat is choice. And the difference between self-choice and choice of God, or as he explains it, the choice of joy. So, all this to say, Lewis encounters, because I think this, as we'll start to see, I do think that the author is someone like Lewis. I think he's kind of imagining himself in this place because he describes himself as a professor and he uses all the same language about his own background. We see that Lewis is guided by MacDonald, and MacDonald kind of becomes this Virgil character. So, you know, if you've ever read Dante, Dante is led through hell and purgatory by Virgil, who kind of leads him on his way towards heaven. And I think that's kind of the role that MacDonald is playing for Lewis. So MacDonald really helps us understand what's happening here. First, he explains what's happening just in general. What's happening to these ghosts? Can they stay? What's the rules of this place? Secondly, he explains the rules, and really that comes down to the idea of choice and how that's worked out in this place. And then finally, he kind of demonstrates and shows Lewis the consequences of this world. So in this week's chapter, that'll be kind of our structure for us to be looking at how George MacDonald explains what's happening, explains the rules, and then shows the consequences of choice. So let's begin with explaining what is happening. Now, up to this point, it's all been kind of a strange dream sequence-y long corridor of kind of, we think we know what's happening, but we're not quite sure. And finally, at this point, George MacDonald just explains it for us. He talks about how this is a, I think it's said refrigerium, which if you think about it, that word sounds like a refrigerator, which is kind of like how we preserve food. And this, he portrays it as this idea of the vacation from hell for these souls. But this actually has a history. So we're reading from the good source of Wikipedia, just to get a little tiny bit of background. Don't worry, I usually wouldn't do that, but this just helps us give a little bit of a summary. And this is what it says. The early Christian theologian Tertullian used the word refrigerium, interim, to describe a happy state in which the souls of the blessed, which would mean the Christians who are saved, are refreshed while they await the last judgment. Later Christians referred to a similar interim state of grace as the bosom of Abraham. Tertullian's notions of refrigerium were a part of a debate on whether souls of the dead had to await the end times, the last judgment, before their entrance into heaven and hell, or, on the other hand, if each soul was assigned a place in eternal afterlife immediately after death. So as you could see, Lewis is really playing with this idea, and I think he goes on to do it even more, because, you know, I guess MacDonald kind of presents it as a vacation from hell, but you also see that in here, it was the idea that it was happy souls waiting for, you know, the final resurrection. And that, I think that actually has something to do with what MacDonald says later, because he basically says, those who were eventually saved, it will always have been heaven, and those who weren't, it will always have been hell. So that's kind of the idea of refrigerium. In the end, all of it will have seemed like heaven, if that was really their space of waiting for the final judgment. So that is where we get what's happening here. These people are coming, and they're being offered the chance to stay in heaven. And Lewis asks all of these sort of questions about, but can they actually stay? And what's the nature of time? And, you know, could it all have been done backwards? And long story short, MacDonald kind of just rejects all of these questions. So, and I think this is very in keeping with Lewis's desire to not see himself as a theologian. It's funny. We all think of him as such an interesting theological writer, but when he was interviewed, he would always say, "Oh, no, I'm not a theologian. I'm really much more of a writer and maybe a philosopher and an English teacher, but not a theologian." So what we see him doing here is more of what he describes in the introduction. It's an imaginative supposal that helps us think about the key thing, and that key thing is choice. So that gets down to this question here. So after Lewis or the narrator has asked, can they stay, and all these questions about time, MacDonald responds and says this: "Do not bother yourself with such questions. You cannot fully understand the relation of choice and time until you are beyond both. And yet we were not brought here to study such curiosity. What concerns you is the nature of choice itself, and that you can watch the making." So here we're kind of given a key to the whole book, that what we're meant to be looking for is the nature of choice itself. And that's what brings us to this kind of second element, which is explaining the rules of heaven and the idea of choice. And as I've already kind of stated, MacDonald, portraying Lewis, of course, gives us this idea that there's really only two kinds of choices that he sees. He sees either the choice for joy or the choice of self. So let me reread this little bit here when it says, "Without that, all who are in hell choose it. And without that self-choice, there could be no hell. No soul that seriously and constantly desires joy will ever miss it." Now, when I did some reading on this last year, I think there's kind of a hidden message in using the word joy, because Lewis uses joy in many of his other writings in this kind of special way. For him, if you think of his book, he has an autobiography called Surprised by Joy, which of course is ironic because he married a woman named Joy Davidman. So I always thought, I always expected to find him writing about how he was surprised to fall in love with Joy, and then he doesn't because he wrote it before that. But anyway, he has this book called Surprised by Joy, and it's his spiritual autobiography. A humorous aside is that his friends called it Suppressed by Jack because they felt like he didn't give the full scope of his life and that he missed a lot. But I've always thought that was both amusing, but also not entirely fair, because the point of it was to chronicle his spiritual autobiography, so how he ended up believing what he believed. So if he excludes a bit, then who might? Who cares? And one of the things that he brings up in this, as is evident from the title, is the idea of joy. Now, he takes Surprised by Joy as a line from a poem by Wordsworth, and he says, "I was surprised by joy, impatient as the wind." And he describes, Wordsworth describes his experience of being taken with this kind of desire and sadness and the sense that there's something greater beyond life itself, and that's contained even in life. And that gets back to a lot of this idea of desire, and the desire is meant to pull us towards reality. And that's really how Lewis uses joy in his other writings. He uses joy as this concept to describe these experiences that both delight us and also urge us to pull ourselves beyond ourselves. That whole idea of the weight of glory, when he talks about, you know, all of the delight we experienced, they weren't in the books or the beauty or the memories or the people. They pointed to something beyond themselves. So that's kind of how I think he's using joy in this sense. When he says, no soul seriously and constantly desires joy will ever miss it. So what he's saying is that if people continuously push beyond the desire into seeing what the God who created that desire, they'll never miss God in that sense. And then that presents us with the opposite of that, which is when we stick with just thinking that the joy was in the things themselves, which is to say that the joy was in the experience provided for us. This is self-choice. So these are ultimately these two different kinds of choices. Now this, of course, could seem a bit limiting, the idea that there's only two kinds of choices. Because it seems like, well, why would God give us the ability to choose if there's really only one choice that we can choose? And everything else will lead us away from him. And to answer this question, this kind of tension, I'm going to look to another author that I love, Thomas Merton, in his book, No Man is an Island. I'm going to read you a small section where he talks about free will and how for us to truly use choice, we have to use it in accordance with reality, which is to say, in accordance with God's will. This is what he says. Free will is not given to us merely as a firework to be shot off into the air. There are some men who seem to think their acts are freer in proportion as they are without purpose, as if a rational purpose imposed some kind of limitation upon us. That is like saying that one is richer if he throws money out the window than if he spends it. Skipping forward a bit. It is for this that we count ourselves happy, when we know his will and do it, and realize that the greatest unhappiness is to have no sense of his purposes or designs, either for ourselves or with the rest of the world. I walked at large, said the psalmist, because I have sought after thy commandments. I have been delighted in the way of thy testimonies and all thy riches. Unless thy law has been meditated, I then perhaps perished in my ejection. We are happy, O Israel, because the things that are pleasing God are made known to us. So essentially what Thomas Merton is saying here is that choosing something isn't free in itself. Freedom is freedom to live into reality and really to live into God's will. Now, this doesn't mean that freedom is just to live into God's will as an autocrat who kind of chooses, everything we'll do. It honors God, like we talked about many, many episodes ago about Mary's choice. You know, when Mary says, be it done to me according to thy will, God honors our choices. But the reality is that we have to choose well, and there should be some kind of direction to our choices. And Lewis's way of talking about this is God's will. And this is not really a popular way of speaking anymore because it sounds rather authoritarian, but really it's not. And especially when you think about Lewis's idea of God's will versus our will, which is saying that to choose God's will is to lean further into reality, into life as it is, whereas to choose our own will is to turn away from reality, to turn inward to our own kind of internal thoughts and the way we feel the world, and to think that reality is only what we feel about reality. And that's reflected again when MacDonald says that hell is a state of mind. which he's saying that hell is if we turned away from all reality and only turned into our own kind of thoughts and machinations and feelings about the world. So these are ultimately the two kind of openings that Lewis is giving us. He's saying that all of these episodes that we're seeing are depictions of this choice between self or God, or really, as he puts it, between joy and God. It's the decision between pushing past seizing things and trying to make those things God, and rather enjoying desire and pushing beyond it towards the source of those desires. And Lewis kind of sets this up for us explicitly. He says, you'll understand there are innumerable forms of this choice, some forms that one hardly thought of on earth. And so with saying this, we kind of begin to see that all of the episodes we're seeing are these options for people to either choose joy or to choose self. And that leads us to our next portion with MacDonald, which is seeing the consequences of these choices. Now, the first one that Lewis brings up is the grumbler. So you see, it's kind of a pitiable image. And I think the reason Lewis brings this up is that he kind of, sometimes it almost seems cruel, but he almost wants to help us see that the things that may destroy our lives and our souls are not always big, brash, terrible things. You know, we want to look at people and say, well, murderers destroy their souls. And that's probably true. But Lewis also wants to say that the little habits that isolate us from people, that make us hate and don't make us love, that make us self-centered, those things also can destroy our souls. So I think that part of the reason he kind of jars us out of this is because he wants us to really consider how all of our choices have an impact upon us. So he gives us this example of the grumbling woman. And basically what boils down to in this episode is that she has become so used to grumbling that she's no longer grumbling about something. She's kind of grumbling to herself. And so she becomes a grumble. I think that's so interesting. That once we give into the self-choice, once we turn inwards, we become phantoms because we're no longer attached to God, to reality, to loving others. All of our desires, instead of pointing outwards to where God meant them to point, to enjoy other people, to love him, to enjoy the natural world, they point inwards only to ourselves. And so we become a phantom. We become the sin that we are rather than looking outward. So we become the grumble. And that's a rather terrifying thought. But this can look in other ways too. And the other person he uses to exemplify this is the artist. And he talks about the artist who gets really upset and doesn't want to stay in heaven because he's told he isn't needed. And that, again, is this kind of turning inwards. He doesn't want to enjoy reality as it is. He wants to enjoy reality as it pertains to him. So instead of being able to look outward and see reality as a gift that he can receive, he wants to turn inward and be noticed, be seen, be used, and be useful. And again, this is not saying that the artist's desire to paint is wrong. What it's saying is that once that desire becomes something that turns inward, he becomes like a phantom who can no longer perceive the beauty and the goodness of the world around him. And so that's kind of the pictures that Lewis gives us, or rather that MacDonald gives us, of how this self-choice versus real choice can be used. What would it look like for these people to be saved? And I think that would be for the grumble to begin to look outside of herself, rather than just grumbling as a way of life, to grumble because she wished for a better world. And for the artist, it's to paint simply because he loved beauty. And this is reflected in what MacDonald says to Lewis. He says, "Aye, but you misunderstand me. The question is whether she's a grumbler or only a grumble. If there's any real woman in there, even the least trace of one, still in there inside the grumbling, it can be brought to life again. If there's one wee spark under all those ashes, we'll blow it to the whole thing as a pile of red and clear. But if there's nothing but ashes, we'll not go on blowing them into our eyes forever. They must be swept up." So we're not meant to look at all of these characters and their self-choices as hopeless people that could never be saved, because the reality is that most of us are closer to the ghosts than we are to the spirits. What we're meant to look at is we're meant to look at them and say, what spark of joy, of that desire to go beyond, is still left in that pile? And I really think for the grumbler, I think that the idea could be, she wants something beyond, something more. There's an insatiability, there's an unsatisfiedness in her that if it truly was an unsatisfiedness that wanted to be satisfied, she could be brought into God. But if she begins to cherish grumbling just because she likes grumbling, if she begins to be unsatisfied and not actually want to be satisfied, then it turns inward and she turns into a phantom. So, is there hope for the grumblers? Well, I think the main hope we begin to see is that our character, Lewis, the narrator, is beginning to get hardened. It's funny, I hadn't actually noticed this the last time I read this, but I've noticed that we're really meant to think the character is becoming progressively more alert and more open to the joy there. Take, for instance, this paragraph. He says, "I obeyed. To lean on the arm of someone older than myself was an experience that carried me back to childhood. And with this support, I found the going tolerable. So much so, indeed, that I flattered myself that my feet were already growing more solid. All a glance at that poor transparent shape convinced me that I owed because of the presence, that my other senses also appeared to be quickened. I noticed scents in the air which hitherto had escaped me, and the country put on new beauties. There was water everywhere and tiny flowers in the early breeze. Far off in the woods, we saw the deer glancing past, and once a sleek panther came to my companion's side. We also saw many of the ghosts." So we begin to hope that our character, because he is leaning on the Spirit, he's not dependent on himself, he's beginning to curve outward from self-choice, begins to taste the beauties and the delights of the world of heaven. And I love also that he says it takes him back to childhood, which reminds me of that passage in Scripture where it says, "For anyone to enter the kingdom, he must be like a child." And what is it that children do? They know that life is a gift, that they need help, they know they need to ask. So that kind of covers this week's chapter. We've seen finally that we know what's happening, that it's a refrigerium, the escape for the souls from hell, or if in the end, if they turn towards goodness, a refreshment that has always been heaven in the end. And that all of this turns on the question of choice, and that choice turns on the question of choosing either self, which is to choose a phantom, is to choose the things that feel inside of us rather than the reality that makes us feel, or the choice of joy, which pushes beyond just the things that we desire into the God who made us to desire them. And we've seen different examples of this, and finally we've seen that as our character begins to choose joy, it begins to get harder and to be able to perceive more of the delights and beauties of heaven. So that's all for this week. I'll be putting up shortly a show notes for all of the chapters up to this point. I believe we have, that'll be 9, 8, 7, and 6. And you could be looking for chapter, I'll probably be doing 2 chapters next week. It will be two podcasts at a time until we finish this book. I wish you all a lovely summer and hope that you are all doing well. Much love.